Welcome to Change Making Connections, the podcast where transformative talks on social justice, leadership, and beyond become more than just words. I'm your host, Beth Varilla. Each month, I invite a global change leader to talk with me about the strategies and tactics that they use to cultivate deep transformation in their lives, their communities, and their organizations. Tune in to Changemaking Connections for your monthly dose of inspiration and insight. Let's create a ripple of change together.
Welcome to Changemaking Connections. Today, I am so thrilled to talk with Jacoby Ballard, who is a social justice educator and yoga teacher on Shoshone, Ute, Paiute, and Goshute land, now known as Salt Lake City, Utah. He leads workshops and trainings around the country on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And that's how I've gotten to know you through that and the yoga and social justice world. As a yoga teacher with 24 years of experience, Jacoby leads workshops, retreats, segments, and teacher trainings, teaches at conferences, and has been an artist in residence on dozens of college campuses. In 2008, Jacoby co-founded Third Root Community Health Center in Brooklyn to work at the nexus of healing and social justice. Since 2006, Jacoby has taught queer and trans yoga, a space for queer folks to unfurl and cultivate resilience, and received Yoga Journal's Game Changer Award in 2014 and Good Karma Award in 2016. Receiving prenatal yoga training in 2021, Jacoby now offers a queer and trans-centered prenatal yoga online and LGBT inclusion workshops and prenatal yoga teacher trainings so that queer families can be anticipated and supported in their process. Jacoby has taught in schools, hospitals, nonprofit, business offices, a maximum security prison, a recovery center, a cancer center, LGBT centers, gyms, a veteran center, and yoga studios. He is the author of A Queer Dharma, Yoga and Meditation for Liberation, released in 2022, a critical love letter to teachers, teachings, and practitioners of yoga and Buddhism, and serves on the board of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. And then your amazing website, which I will put in the chat. Welcome. I'm so glad to be with you today.
Thank you so much. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've seen each other in person. That was many years ago in New York with Teo and Hala and family. And there's one other person. I think your partner in something.
Molly Kitchen.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's good to see you again. So I have been holding your book dear to my heart, A Queer Dharma, Yoga and Meditations for Liberation. I think it's something that has just been a balm for me. And part of why I invited you to be on this podcast was both because I just wanted to talk with you again. And also because there's just so much going on in this world and so much happening in our communities, so many targets. So many assaults on queer and trans communities, particularly trans communities. And I feel like your book is really healing and necessary in that context to move us into healing and liberation. And so I'm curious what drew you to write the book and teach queer and trans yoga, which you do so beautifully.
Well, nowadays, you know, affinity yoga classes are barely widespread, but I started teaching yoga for all genders at the New York City LGBT Center in 2006, and then queer and trans yoga at Third Root starting in 2008. And one thing that I heard immediately from like larger yoga community is like, why are you separating? Isn't that an exclusive space? Why aren't you? Why is this necessary? And so the book began as a response to that. And so I wrote the second part of the book, Queering Yoga, first. And then along the way, I got really touched and impacted by the Brahma Viharas, the divine abodes of loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And that totally transformed my relationships, the way I taught, my work, and how I did social justice work. So it felt like I needed to also share that and, you know, really hold Sharon Salzberg's Loving Kindness book close to my heart, and also wanted like a queer or social justice version, other stories to relate to. So I made it as an offering, and Angel Kyoto Williams told me years ago, such helpful information when I was like in my 20s and just like pissed at like all the yoga spaces that weren't diverse enough or that were doing spiritual bypass around talking about oppression. I was just like overwhelmed by it. And Angel told me, if you don't see something that's happening in these spaces, that's because it's your offering to make. And I was like, oh, damn, Angel. Okay.
Wow. Challenge laid down.
Yeah. I was like, okay, I'm not the victim. And so my book was like, is an offering. And, you know, I felt like it's important to talk about cultural appropriation. It's important to talk about kind of pull back the curtain on the yoga industry, because a lot of people that practice yoga have no idea what it takes and the complexities of studios and gyms and yoga teacher trainings and everything. And it felt important to share. And then also, you know, I interviewed some of our colleagues around liberatory models of yoga who are like really using the teachings and the very structure of the organizations or the policies and practices of the organizations that they lead. So I didn't want to just, you know, offer a critique with no solution, or at least an offering. It's not the solution, but perhaps one of many, many.
And it really is, for me anyway, and I'm sure for many other people and for all the people who take your classes. I had a gift of practicing in one of your classes during the pandemic with my wife. And first of all, I was like, oh, about a sheep. But it was also like just such a gift to be in those spaces with other queer folk around the country and with you holding space for that and feeling seen and heard. And the I think one of the gifts you give at so many of our colleagues in the yoga and social justice world is recognizing that the practice of yoga, and also I think for Buddhism, is being able to hold those principles while not just on your mat, but also in the world. And I know part of my journey in the yoga world, I was also trained as a yoga teacher, and just really feeling a dissonance anytime I brought social justice or injustice into the spaces, predominantly white spaces at the time, predominantly class privileged spaces, it was seen as disrupting the peace instead of, why is this group a fairly homogenous group? And why aren't other people in these rooms? Mm-hmm. And if we're really practicing the principles of these teachings, it shouldn't be an anomaly to talk about what's happened, you know, the hard stuff in the world. And what's been really a gift in recent years, although I think it's been happening for a long time, but just like, I didn't find it until I tapped into the yoga and social justice world, is just how many beautiful, rich teachings, programs, offerings are out there that blend the two with integrity, and yours is one of them.
Yeah, there's more and more. I don't even know them all anymore. It's such a wonderful problem to have.
Yes, fantastic. And so what are some of the particular insights from this book that you try to integrate into your teachings? And in particular, also, you mentioned as you were talking, in your own journey, integrating equanimity and loving kindness in your social justice work, which is challenging.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, I often teach from the Brahma Viharas when I'm teaching my live classes and workshops and retreats, because it's both so familiar and timelessly relevant. You know, it's there's never a time where like compassion is like out of style. And, you know, I write about the Brahma Viharas, but also write about anger and forgiveness, because that always comes up when I'm teaching about the four traditional Brahma Viharas. And, you know, so many of us have had our anger at very real, impactful injustices dismissed or vilified or pushed away, you know, and at the same time, we can't stay angry. That doesn't do us individually any good, because it's going to eat our bodies from the inside out and our hearts, and then collectively, right? Like if I'm remaining in a space of anger, I'm going to bring that to my partner. I'm going to bring that to my kid. I'm going to bring that into this very conversation, right? And that's going to prevent the deepest connection that I actually could have. At the same time, I don't want to dismiss anger. Right? It's so important. It's telling us that something's wrong. And there's wisdom there. But part of what I read about in the book, you know, is figuring out discharge practices, ways to move the energy of anger so that we're not frightening one another and we're not breaking bridges. We're building them with the wisdom that's underneath. So yeah, I've worked with so many different activists, whether I encounter them in yoga teacher trainings or various workshops, that are seething with rage and also about to burn out if they haven't already burned out. And so it seems, you know, really important to talk about anger. And I know a lot of us that are doing yoga and social justice work, that's a keystone of our offering, because it's so important to our communities right now, with queer communities under attack, with the genocide in Gaza, with the history on Turtle Island. Like, there's so much to be angry about. And so we need to skill up on how to be with
it. Yeah, thank you for that. I remember being in a workshop with generative somatics and had the gift of learning. Prentice Hemphill was one of the teachers, and just like, whoa. And I remember some of the feedback Prentice gave me. Prentice looked at me and said, "I wonder about your relationship to your anger." And I was like, not long. One of those like, oof, yes, okay. And I thought I was showing up so skillfully. And I've been sitting with that since. Prentice offered me a couple of kernels of wisdom that I have been sitting with since. And the idea, well, first of all, the different ways people are, who is allowed to show anger and who isn't, and in what ways. And then that anger tends to get so demonized when it's about social injustice. I mean, I think entitlement anger sometimes gets allowed, but anger where it's like, these are my communities, this is my lived experience. And anytime one raises concerns about that from a place of really any place, but including anger, it gets dismissed. And yet, so like anger being, I love that you talk about it. There's a wisdom underneath it, right? I think it was Larry Yang who said something about, it's a signal that a boundary has been crossed. That was like, wow, right. What is this anger signaling? But then, as I often share with my students, and as you just said, it can really eat away at us if we don't learn how to metabolize it and catalyze it towards something. You talked about affinity spaces, and you teach really beautiful queer and trans yoga spaces. What makes it queer and trans yoga? How do you queer it?
I love that question, and I wrote a whole chapter about it. it's part is just like the relationships and how people are relating to each other in this space. There's queer culture present, which is like, you know, sometimes really sassy, sometimes really snarky, sometimes really gentle and quiet, sometimes really kind of, some of us can be quite reclusive. So that's present. And then, you know, along part of our culture is, right, like the musician, the queer musicians. And so trying to play our music, trying to read our poems, trying to, you know, different reference points. Like 1 month ago in Utah, there was an anti-trans bill that was passed. And so like the following Monday, that was, you know, that was on everyone's mind, heart in the room. And so speaking to that, and then also at other moments when there's like visitors from out of state in my class, like they bring different, you know, someone from Florida will bring what queer communities are going through there, or someone from Oklahoma will bring the grief of Next Benedict's murder. So having those like consistent reference points and, you know, staying up to date on like not just what my local queer community and my friends are impacted by, but like more broadly, because that helps me be a better teacher and my offering be more relevant. And then, you know, there's just things that are not normative. Like people sometimes don't practice on a yoga mat. They'll wear tweed jackets and sequin pants, or, you know, they won't wear yoga gear. And there's such a rebellion in that, and also a reclaiming of that. This is a practice that's totally meaningful to us, and we're going to do it our way. It's going to look like this.
Yes. Yes. One of my other guests, Dr. Joel Davis Brown, talked about queer verve, right? The magic and the sass and the style that queer communities bring and just the creativity and wisdom that comes in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and how we like mirror that and shine that on one another, and it grows or reverberates
Absolutely. Yes, even reading your book, I giggled when you're like, add a playlist with Barbara Streisand. I was like, of course you do. And I would just, in a room, I mean, I haven't had the gift of practicing with you in person yet, but in the room, I would just feel so much joy. I'm sure I would giggle in the middle of downward dog if that came on.
Totally, but a funny thing is, Beth, is that now I'm like, I'm almost 45, and the young ones are listening to different music.
Yes, yes.
I have to stay up to date with them,
yes,
too.
Yes, of course. Of course. Oh, so beautiful. And the connection that people get in just being seen and being able to show up however they are. Hopefully with a little less guardedness or armor than they might if they were in a mainstream yoga class, and knowing that whatever needs to happen is okay here. Armored, if you're not armored, if you can let it down a little, or if you can't, you're held here.
Right. And for me, like not taking it personally, however anyone shows up, it's not about me. And it's about everything that preceded that moment. Mm-hmm. And if I made the mistake of judging them, then that space would no longer be for them. And if I can meet their armor with kindness, or last night in my class, I had a queer teenager who laid on her back and like wrapped the yoga mat around her, the whole class, and like didn't do any of the practices. But she was in their room. She was watching this room full of queer, sassy, vibrant adults. And I was like, this is really good for you.
Yeah.
Because clearly she was holding shame in her body, and other people were mirroring back to her, like, what a reverent, self-possessed queer life can look like. Wow. And I wish I had that.
Yeah, totally. Totally. So many important messages there that a person could show up however. Which pronoun did you use?
I use she, but I don't. She. This person did not talk, so
okay.
I didn't.
Okay. That she could show up however she wanted and still be a part of the community, that she wasn't going to be judged by other people or the teacher in however she needed, that there was some coping mechanism and care that she took with herself by wrapping herself in the mat, and that the energy of everybody else in the room was just like she was exposed to it. It probably affected her in some way, and that she could just be connected and held. Yeah, a lot of us didn't get that as queer folk.
Yeah.
Younger or now.
Totally.
Yeah, and how important that is. That's really beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you for offering those spaces.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been teaching queer and trans yoga for almost 20 years now, so I've learned some things along the way, and try to, just meeting people with compassion and presence, and like getting to know them. Like when someone enters my class for this first time, I introduce myself. I ask them like, how did you find yourself here? Is there anything you want me to know about your body? And another new person in my class last night, the first thing they said was they, them pronouns. And it was clear to me, like, they've been in spaces where they're consistently misgendered. And so the most important thing for them was the pronoun, like not anything about the shoulder injury or hamstring. It was like, this is what will make me safe right now in this moment, or allow me to even feel my hamstring. Who knows what's happening with my hamstring when I'm misgendered all the time?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that right there says a lot that I think all yoga teachers need to hear of all identities, right? This is one of the reasons why affinity spaces are so important.
Yep.
Can you speak to that a little bit more in yoga spaces, especially?
Yeah. I mean, we don't have to explain ourselves and have a context for one another shows up. In every one of my students, I can see myself, different versions of myself, right? The armored, pissed off person who's like looking for anything to go wrong. I've had plenty of students like that and receive their projections, you know, but also try to like meet it with kindness, with integrity and boundary, and welcome them back to know that it's like they feel safe enough to like offer that feedback in that space. But it's like largely not about me. And to just be around one another and like embody possibility models for one another, and then getting to know each other and how everyone lives their practice and their queerness and their day-to-day lives. I've seen so many, one of the special things that about queer and trans yoga, and I assume it would be the case about other affinity spaces, is that people then form relationships outside of class. They meet there and then they become friends or roommates or lovers or colleagues or whatever, or help each other move. And then there's just like more and more kind of community, collective culture in the room that then like draws in other people that are like, that come in for the first time, because there's this collective energy like, oh, we have a potluck on Sundays that we do as participants of this class. Do you want to come? Or, oh, Becky's moving on Friday. Do you want to come help too? And just like there's this culture of inclusion that I try to set from the beginning. And then, you know, once you get that rolling, like I don't have to do anything. I just stand back and watch the magic of it. And then, yeah, certain practices in affinity spaces, like we do a go round and we say pronouns every single time. And sometimes people's pronouns change it, you know, and so we like pay attention to that, or their names change or whatever. And then I'll also say that, you know, a sweet thing I've experienced is parents bringing their queer kids to the space. And they often will email or write to me and ask me if like, that's okay. Like they don't identify as queer, but they want their kid in the space. And I'm always like, absolutely. If that's how your kiddo is going to get into the space, please, please come. And also you'll probably learn something about the culture that your kid is potentially stepping into. So they don't have to do all the education of you. Or not about affinity spaces, but just being out trans teacher, I've had so many parents of trans kids who are yogis contact me and like want to figure it out, want to figure out how to do right by their kid. And I'm the person that they see as a potential contact and guide for that. And that's been really sweet.
That is really sweet. It warms my heart to know. And this is, of course, this would be the case, but unfortunately, it's not always the case that so many parents do want to honor their kids' identities and understand how to do that effectively and create the spaces for that to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when we were getting ready for this recording, you dropped the little exciting tidbit that you're thinking about a new book. And you raised some topics that I think are really important in social justice and social transformation work these days. You want to talk a little bit about how you're thinking about that next offering?
Yeah. As I've done forgiveness work, you know, I wrote a whole chapter in A Queer Dharma on forgiveness. And then I've offered whole retreats and workshops just on forgiveness. Just being out there doing that work, several people have contacted me who have experienced different forms of cancellation or exclusion. And, it's gotten me intrigued about, and some of them have been involved in formal accountability processes through social justice worlds and communities, and some of them have not. But it got me intrigued about cancellations and how we turn on each other in social justice world and in queer communities, and, you know, use the very tools of the prison industrial complex of shame, isolation, blame, and punishment against one another. And what that does in our movements, right, is it makes it smaller. Our movements are then contract because a lot of people don't feel safe and, you know, or brave or held or feel like they could be turned on at any moment. I've listened to the stories of these people, some of whom, you know, their closest people turned on them and suddenly did not see their basic goodness or the friendship that they had held for a decade or more. And then some people, a dear friend reported that no one in his closest circle turned on him. And so that also got me intrigued. Like, what is it about, like, how do we form relationships? How do we do our work in a way that creates belonging for each of us, even when we make our worst mistakes, or not even our worst mistakes? Some of them are like fairly minor mistakes, but we're all human. We're all bound to make mistakes, and we're bound to make them in our relationships, in our organizations, And so then what do we do when that happens in a way that grows our movement rather than shrinks it?
Oh boy, if we could figure that out. I mean, in your book, Queer Dharma, you talk about calling in. And, you know, with my students, I talk a lot about there are times and places to call out and versus calling in, or as Teo Drake once told me, calling forward to our best selves. And I think the calling out strategy can be helpful when there's a massive power imbalance, when other strategies haven't worked, when there are so many degrees of separation that you can't get to the person to have a calling in conversation.
Yeah.
But I've also watched some of the cancellations that have happened, even with like politicians or whatever. And I've wondered, like, yes, there needs to be accountability, but where's the road back? Where's the road to, okay, I made a misstep. I need to be accountable for it. Here's my process for unlearning. Not the immediate apology that clearly means nothing because you can't unlearn things that quickly.
Right.
But the like, okay, and I'm literally grappling with this. I don't have answers to this, Jacoby, but I'm wondering like, okay, we kick them out, but then eventually that could be me. That could be you. That could be anyone. So where's the road to repair and accountability in a way that feels authentic and meaningful, that sets the boundaries around, I can't be around you right now because it's too harmful, but that also allows for future connection. I don't know. I don't know where those lines are, but it seems really important to find them. And I know there are beautiful social justice organizations, people, practices that try to engage that. Yeah, but I don't really know. It does seem really important.
Yeah. And, you know, something that when I teach forgiveness workshops, something that comes up every time is there anything that's not forgivable? And I say, no, everything is forgivable. That there's nothing that's beyond repair. And I know, you know, that doesn't necessarily mean that a survivor of sexual violence needs to like be in a house or organization or even a community with the person that harmed them. But that person who harmed them still, you know, they're not going to heal if they're isolated, if they're shamed, if they're blamed, if they're punished. The Buddha said that hatred does not cease by hatred, but by love alone, right? So how can we love them back into their basic goodness? It's not everyone's work to do that, right? But it's part of the call in social justice community is to get our people, right? Whether that's like cisgendered men calling in cisgendered men that have sexually violated people, or whether that is all the Karens of the world going towards the Karens and being like, come on, honey, we can do better than that. There's so much more than that.
Yeah. I wish I could like just hang out with you on a weekly basis. Because there's just, I mean, it strikes me that this is also a very queer thing. And I've seen this in other marginalized groups as well, that one of the coping strategies is to be able to meet deep harm with some humor and some, it's a coping mechanism, I think, that doesn't just miss the harm, but also still find some heart openness and some joy.
Yeah, we need some levity in it, right?
Yeah.
Harm.
It's hard. Yes, it is. I think it's important to note, since people, I think, are listening to this from a variety of different awareness levels around social justice and other work, that when I talk about love and when I hear you talk about love, I hear a love of the deep humanity and possibility in a person, but not a dismissal. Like, it's not a Pollyanna love. It's not a anything goes love. It's more like the revolutionary love of Valerie Kaur, right? And you talk in here about spiritual bypassing, that it's not a like jump over everything kind of love. But ultimately, if we want a world of liberation, I for one want love to be a part of that. And I want everybody to come along. And we all have different work to do to get there. But if we just write off certain people as, well, there's no possibility for you, you're dismissed, you're canceled, where does that leave us ultimately?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I know that like so many white folks have grappled with like, what's our role in social justice post 2020,
yeah,
right? Or men stepping back from leadership, but like they have skills, they have knowledge, they have wisdom. What do they do with that? Like, it would be a shame for it to just leave the movement, you know? And so how do we, there's a spiritual teaching from Neem Karoli Baba that there's no throwaway people. And I think our social justice movements could really learn from that, that everyone does have a role. And like, yes, we want to center BIPOC folks, Indigenous folks. We want to center trans folks. We want to center those who have been, you know, the most targeted and marginalized. And even in that centering, what about all the other people? What are the roles for them? And there's work for them to do, to, you know, for those of us that have been centered for centuries, there's work for us of like, what does followership mean? What are the practices that I need to skill up on in order to center BIPOC folks or women or trans folks or disabled folks? What kind of humility does that demand in me? But then also what kind of creativity, right? Because if like, I can't be at the center, how can I like, I'm a plant person, I'm an herbalist. I think of roots in the soil, right? When they meet a rock, they go around the rock to get to the water. And so how can we take that invitation to decenter ourselves as people with privilege as an opportunity into our most creative selves? How can I still participate in social justice movement, not at the center?
Yeah, good question. I think I was thinking as you were talking, it's funny you brought up the plant imagery, because I went to ecosystems and kind of like the inherited ecosystem, at least in the Western culture, in which I've grown up in, centers certain people and certain structures. But an ecosystem that is healthy, like everything has a role, every being, nothing, every being has a role. So when you're decentered, what's another role those gifts can offer, right? It's not that your voice isn't important. It's how can we collectively create mutually supportive relations with one another that draws on the creativity and all the gifts we can each offer in different sets of relationships than the structures we currently have. And how might that lead even those who were previously centered to liberation? Because being centered doesn't mean you're liberated. And being privileged doesn't mean, it means you get privilege, but I think it cuts privileged people off from their humanity and their authentic connections with other people from who are not centered. Right.
Total. Yeah.
So there's something in it for everyone, so to speak. Like there's greater possibility for everyone. Mm-hmm. But it's a practice. And for people who don't have practices, how do you think of practice? People who don't come from yoga or meditation worlds.
What are the reinforcements? What are the things that you do again and again to train your nervous system, your body, your heart in a different way of being that maybe you weren't grown up with? Maybe culture wasn't indoctrinating you with from the get-go, but that ultimately serves liberation, serves connection, serves our individual health and vitality and collective health and vitality. So practices could be something as simple as like taking a breath when you're presented with a conflict and not just like going right into it. Or not sleeping with your phone next to your bed at night so you have a little space, or getting really serious about sleep hygiene and what promotes rest, and how often do you take naps? How often do you take vacations or days off? Not as a retreat from the very meaningful work in the world, but to resource yourself, because the world needs each of us resourced. Or, you know, what are your artistic practices? What are your practices with your friends? Like I know for myself, one of my non-negotiables is to talk to a beloved every day, whether that's in person or on the phone, because those connections are so important. I care about these people and they also remind me of who I am. So the practices could be quiet. The practices could be in public. They're not for show. I don't, you know, when I teach yoga, I'm always like, this headstand is not a party trick. Like what we're learning is to like be uncomfortable with being discombobulated and familiarity with discomfort. We're not like actually learning how to go upside down is like beside the point.
Yeah, it really has shifted both my daily life and my social justice work not that those things are separated, but to relate to things as a practice has really shifted everything for me. And it was, my journey was through mindfulness and then yoga and then somatics and Buddhism. There are other paths to that, but just that idea of building in the anchor points. I'm a ritual person or a habit person. If I don't have those habits, like my morning cup of coffee or something like that, I get up and I read wisdom, sometimes your book, sometimes other people's books, to just shape my day. And that's really important. And then when you veer off from it, which inevitably might happen, the opportunity to come back to it. Same with social justice work. I think it's a really beautiful practice. And the gift that you said, big or small, you know, public or private, we get to shape which practices work best for us, but having them, I think, are really important. And rooting them in what we care about and our belief systems and who we want to be in the world and what we want for our communities.
Yeah. Totally. And the ritual part of it, whether it's like daily or nightly or seasonally or whatever, the coming back is so important in it, because inevitably, like, you've lived a life since the last time you've meditated. You've lived a life since the last time you took a purposeful deep breath. Mm-hmm. And that returning is so important.
Yeah. So we're reaching the end of our time, which is unfortunate because I love talking with you. One of the things I like to ask all of my guests is, what gives you hope? I think we need hope in this world. Or what do you, where and how do you grow hope?
I mean, seeing people transform their lives, you know, whether that's like a yoga student that came to me in Brooklyn 10 years ago and then started taking my pandemic classes and then started getting more and more interested in social justice work as we face the racial reckoning. And he is a straight white man, entered social work school. And now that's what he does. That's his contribution. Or, you know, watching someone like those students that I mentioned from my class last night, like what happens as they come back again and again. Like I had, when you were talking about being armored, I was thinking about one specific student who came to my class completely shut down and like vigilant and not able to connect with anyone. And now she's so relaxed and she like moves in a different way and she's smiling, where like 5 years ago, her smiling in a space would be unthinkable. Mm. Yeah, just watching people grow and stretch and those little transformations and then bigger things. You know, I try to, forgiveness practice is so important for me because it gives me that hope and inspiration that like people can take the worst harms in the world and shift it into something beautiful. And so I try to read stories, and people send them to me all the time now, forgiveness stories, whether it's like around a public reconciliation or whether it's like, someone taking in someone as their like foster kid that was, you know, some sort of enemy to begin with. Because it's just to see the ability to turn, you know, the muddiest mud into the most beautiful lotus flower.
Yeah. Yeah. That's beautiful. What a beautiful image. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me and for your beautiful being and work in the world, Jacoby.
Well, thank you so much, Beth. We should do this more often on an awesome podcast.
Yes, yes, we should. I'll put the information about your book and your offerings in the show notes for listeners. Jacoby offers amazing retreats and classes that can be taken from, you offer online classes still, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, as well as in person. And so check it out. And thank you, Jacoby.
Thank you, Beth.